Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is John Nichols, who has been an Alexander Technique teacher for over 30 years. He trained in London with Walter and Dillis Carrington, and he spent a lot of time working with them on their training course after he qualified. He's been the director or co-director of a number of Alexander Technique training programs, and currently he is one of the two directors of the AT New York City teacher training course. And John lives in New York City. And we're going to talk today about the teaching of Walter Carrington and what made it so special and unique. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you. I think it might be interesting to begin with you just saying a little bit about how it is that you met Walter and what was the initial results of that.
Well, round about the late 60s, it would have been, I was living in London, beginning of the 70s. And exploring things like that, there was the wave of interest in things like transcendental meditation and other Eastern disciplines. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the time the Beatles went off to India to stay with the Maharishi. So, you know, like people of that age at that time, I was exploring some of that, and mainly trying to meditate and trying to practice yoga simply made me aware that I was a mental psychological mess and that this had something to do with being a mass of physical tension. These two things were perhaps not entirely unrelated to each other. So I looked around for more things that might help. And I was going to a place in London where they offered a whole range of like an a la carte menu straight from the Esalen Institute in mm-hmm. California.
Right.
You know, you remember that kind? You could do encounter groups and eclectic body awareness groups and gestalt groups, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And one day I saw a little sign on the notice board. It said, Friday evening lecture demo, Alexander Technique. And I'd read about that in Aldous Huxley's books. Mm-hmm. And I thought it had died out.
Right.
Nobody seemed to have heard. And there was no internet. You couldn't just Google this stuff then.
Right.
So I thought, my, this thing's still alive. This thing that Huxley wrote about. So I went to the lecture demo, and it was kind of okay, but nothing much. But I was intrigued. And I then discovered that there was a place 10 minutes walk from where I was then living in London, a place called the Constructive Teaching Center. So I phoned them up and said, hey, can I try some Alexander lessons? And they booked me in for a 6:30 in the evening appointment with Walter Carrington, about whom I knew absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. So I went along and I met this very likable, very benign, very courteous gentleman. And he took me into his room and he talked to me for a bit, and then he put his hands on me for a bit. And this is the point where I'm supposed to tell you about how amazing it felt. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't feel anything. Mm-hmm. And I walked out. I remember talking to a friend later that evening who said, well, what was that like? And I said, well, he's a very nice old chap. But I didn't actually get that hit from his hands that people talk about. Now, I'll tell you something in a minute or so as to why that might have been, because I think I was in such a mess, and I had I was intrigued, though. Something about it was fascinating, even though I didn't feel benefit. Mm-hmm. And I took lessons at his advice from one of the assistant teachers there. And I can vividly recall it was after the 17th lesson
Wow.
Now, yeah. I have been teaching, 36 years, I think, now. And it's pretty rare that you come across somebody who keeps going for 17 lessons without feeling anything, isn't it?
It's highly unusual, but I have to say, in some ways, I followed that pattern, but with a slight variant that I never felt a single thing during any Alexander lesson, and I had quite a few before going on the training course. And I didn't feel anything on the training course until about halfway through, but I did have almost immediate things changing, even starting the day after my first lesson, that were obviously connected with it. So for the longest time, it never occurred to me that anyone was supposed to notice anything for the first few lessons. And I was kind of amazed when I started teaching in Toronto in the early 80s that people would say, oh, that feels so different. And all. And I thought, really? You can actually sense it? So that's a fascinating, fascinating story.
Yeah.
And so you obviously continued with those lessons beyond the 17, and
yeah.
I guess at some point you decided to train.
At some point, the possibility came up of training. And since, I'd been going to the Carrington's place, I don't think I was living quite so close by that time, but it was the obvious place to go and train.
Right, right. Well, I first met Walter when I had pretty much decided I wanted to train. And there were, at that time, this was the late 77 in there, there were really only four possible options. And, of course, Walter was one of them. And at that point, he had quite a long waiting list. And he encouraged me to go and check out the course run by, that just started by Paul and Betty Collins, who were students of his, and who were really represented the first, second generation teachers running training courses. But I remember him pretty much as you describe, very easy to be in his presence kind of guy, he just put you right at ease, and you just felt like you could literally put yourself in his hands.
He generated a sense that you felt completely safe and confident.
Exactly. And while I didn't sign on to his course, I managed to have three or four lessons a year with him, and I would visit his course every term. I probably saw you on his course because I was there. I graduated in 81.
Yeah, you and I met quite a few times back in the late 70s.
Absolutely. I think we actually met. We even met earlier because you and Paul Collins were running a course out in the country.
Oh, that's right.
It was when I was looking for training courses, and it just happened to be going on at the same time. So this quality of Walter's, I noticed that it permeated. I could sense that when I visited his training course, it sort of permeated the atmosphere there. It was like when Walter was in the room, everyone there knew everything was going to be okay. And I have to say, that's a really, it's an interesting way of teaching or running a training course. I think not all training courses are quite that way. Would that be your experience? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's several things I could say about that. Let's start with, I remember after Walter died, there was an obituary in the London Times. And a word that was used very prominently in the obituary is the word benevolence.
Yes.
And it's just the word that comes to mind to anybody who knew Walter. And I was around him. I was, you know, had this terrific opportunity to be invited to stay on as a 5-day-a-week teaching assistant. And I spent the next 11 years there. And I'm saying this because it meant I was around him a lot. And I remember somebody one day coming in to visit just for the afternoon. And when leaving, saying to me, "I'd love to know what lies behind that mask of benevolence," said about Walter. Yeah. And I just found myself utterly spontaneously saying, "You know what? I've been around him a long time. I really believe behind that mask of benevolence, there lies a truly benevolent man."
Yeah, that would be my sense too.
That's a remarkable thing.
That is a remarkable thing. And that, you know, when you put it that way, that is totally my sense of him as well.
Good.
That was not, there was no act going on there. He really was, what you saw is what you got with Walter.
Yeah, the real deal.
He was the real deal.
And I asked him, and going with that was this sense that he had a constant sense of enjoyment of life. Almost joyful. That sounds like a dramatic word, but let's say in a quiet way.
Right.
And at one point when I was living in Melbourne, Australia, and he came over, I was interviewing him then for the Aussie-based Direction Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought this up. At the end of the interview, I said, "You know, we all notice this quality you have. Do you think that comes from a lifetime of putting the Alexander technique into practice?" And in his very lovely, understated kind of way, he simply laughed and he said, "Well, I don't know what else it could be." That was all he would say about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that whole take on Walter, that aspect of Walter, it leads me to another question that I think is somewhat related. I once, as I'm sure you must have experienced over and over again, and when you had a lesson with him, you didn't just get a lesson, you got a little talk that went with it. Yes. It would begin a few minutes into the lesson and pretty much end at the end of the lesson. Mm-hmm. And it was, there was always some connection to what your current situation was, although you might not realize it at the time. But I remember once asking him, kind of preempting his talk, asking him, when does he start explaining some of the Alexander technique principles to a new student? And he said, he was pretty emphatic about this. He told me he would do everything in his power to not discuss the Alexander technique for at least 10 lessons with any new student. And my understanding was that it was a way of his idea was he wanted to give people the experience so they would be at a point where they could usefully take in the ideas. Does that resonate with you at all, or do you have a different take on that?
Well, it resonates in the sense that, yes, I have heard him say that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a different take in the sense that I wouldn't try to teach that way.
Oh, me neither. But I was intrigued by that approach.
I think a little bit of it might help to see a kind of the historical background there.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, the first generation teachers said that when FM took on a new person, he had them come 5 times a week for the first 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine asking somebody today, "Oh, I want you to take 15 lessons in the next 3 weeks."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even if they've got the money, they don't have the time.
Right.
And they don't want to put that amount of time into it. They think, right. why should it take that much?
Mm-hmm.
When I was first around Walter, it was still normal, standard there. If a new person wanted to take lessons with Walter, they had to come 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd backed off a little from the 5. So when he would talk about, I want them to have the experience for the first 10 lessons.
It was just 3 weeks.
That would be like 3 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, see, now I didn't put that together. Yeah.
It's a different era and a different ethos.
Yeah. And I think at the point I asked him that question, I think it came up in my mind because I had become exposed to the teaching of Marjorie Barstow and had gone to a few workshops with her. And her approach was in some ways diametrically the opposite of that. In other words, she would, if it seemed like it was going to be useful, she would get people to start thinking about what was going on with themselves and the other people in the room the first day they showed up, even if they never had an Alexander lesson before in their lives. And it was it was a very, very, and I remember actually coming back from the first of her workshops back to my training course, which was I was about halfway through. And the thing that struck me about the course was suddenly everything seemed really slow. And it, not in a bad way. I enjoyed my training course immensely, but it just seemed so slow. And I think it was around that time that I asked Walter about his teaching approach.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So,
I found having had this marvelous opportunity, like an extended apprenticeship, both alongside him in the teacher training class every day, and Dillis, and quickly building up a private practice there, and being able to give lessons to some of their students and so on.
Right.
I went off to live in Australia, and well, that's a very different culture and a very different in the sense that. People want to know now. They want to have their questions answered. They want to learn. They want to get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd already figured out by then, teaching people in their mid-20s in London in the 1980s, it seemed to me that there was something wonderful going on with Walter and Dillis. There was a fundamental about the Alexander technique, its basic principles, the way you use your hands to communicate them. There was something wonderful, but you had to find a different way to communicate that in the modern world. And that particular, you know, that was already apparent to me in 1980s London.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started set up in Melbourne with a training course in private practice, and of course now I'm living in New York, you know, a guy came in to see me. This is almost like a parody, but there's a guy coming in and he's had a few lessons from someone else. He's a New York journalist, and I kind of politely inquired whether he managed to lie down the way we recommend. And he said, yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's very good. How long do you manage to do that for? He said, 2 minutes. I said, 2 minutes?
He said,
hey, I'm a New Yorker. What do you expect?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we have to deal with the environment and the people and the kind of popular culture, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so I take people and one lesson a week. And of course, you've got to get them thinking. You've got to develop their awareness and their conscious intention capacity, whether it's an inhibitory intention or a directive one, from very, very early on, from the first lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what people need and expect in this environment, and you can do it.
Oh, absolutely.
You definitely can do it. Yes.
And I guess that kind of suggests that Walter's role and the role of those other teachers that were, you know, were prominent after Alexander died, people like MacDonald and certainly Marge Barstow, is that they created a kind of a foundation out of which teachers came, like yourself, who probably, you know, taught in different ways, but had that basic foundation to get them started.
Yes.
And that maybe that foundation that those few teachers were, I don't want to say preserving, but exhibiting or manifesting, that that foundation itself is not as important now as it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, there I actually disagree.
Okay.
In the sense that I think the foundation is every bit as important, and I feel very much I want to pass on that foundation as much as possible. It's not the foundation that is problematic. I'm more and more, as the years go by, I find I'm really what I'm aiming to communicate, both in a training course and in private lessons and groups and postgrad classes. I really do feel it's the core and the essence of what I learned from Walter and Dilys, and that is the foundation. I think it can be presented more succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people can be, as I say, encouraged to develop that awareness more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see that as being as saying, oh, the foundation is less important.
Yeah,
I never saw Walter's. You see, to me, Walter's attitude that, oh, I don't want to, you know, teach them anything till they've really had 10 lessons, to me, that isn't part of the foundation of what I learned from him. That was his particular take at his in his place and time.
Yeah.
It wasn't foundational,
yeah.
I don't
think. Okay, yeah. I guess I hadn't thought through the meaning of the word foundation that fully. So the foundation, yeah, I would agree with you. The foundation, in the sense you're talking about, is important. And in my case, I think of the foundation I got from Marge Barstow and to a certain extent from, you know, Paul and Betty and Walter. But for me, primarily Marge. And I use her ideas all the time, but I don't teach the way she taught necessarily.
Yeah.
I use different language. I use different ways of approaching new students. So I guess, okay, I would agree with you about the foundation. It's more, you might say, the delivery system has changed.
Yeah, the delivery system.
That's really, I think that's maybe. Yeah. And, but I think also that those early teachers, the ones who, you know, came to the fore after Alexander died, they had on their shoulders a pretty big responsibility, because I would imagine that if you went back to London in the late 50s or early 60s, where there were very few teachers anywhere in the world, but even in London, it would not have been all that difficult for the Alexander technique to have pretty much disappeared.
That's what I've heard, and you've heard too. You know, I mean, I believe somewhere in the early to mid-60s,
mm-hmm.
Walter's training course, I think, was down to about 3 people.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the situation was with Patrick MacDonald or the Barlows, but generally the impression I've gotten is that they felt it could have died out at that point.
Right. And by the time I arrived in London, things had picked up pretty dramatically, I think in large part, my sense, in large part because of Wilfred Barlow's book. That seemed to have generated a lot of new interest, and maybe some other factors as well.
Yeah, there were other factors before, because I remember I was already having lessons when that book came out.
Mm-hmm.
And Lansdowne Road had clearly picked up. And I asked Walter at some point about this. And I also asked, I think it might have been Marjorie Barlow, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Another contributing factor was the Barlows getting connected to, I think it was the Royal College of Music. Yeah,
oh,
the Royal College
okay.
of Music.
Yes, okay.
And they'd given a lot of lessons to also in the voice teaching world in one of the drama colleges, and I don't recall which one. A woman called Joyce Woodall, or I think I've got that second name slightly wrong,
mm-hmm.
but the technique started getting into those performing arts academies. And then a third thing was actually, Walter laughed and said, well, it was people like you, John. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you kind of vaguely hippie-ish types
right.
who were into this Eastern stuff and all
right.
that kind of thing.
Right. But one could certainly imagine that without certain connections having been made and the right people being at the right place, that there might hardly not be any Alexander technique today.
Yes.
And,
yes.
I know that at that time, if we go back to the 60s, I know that Marge Barstow was here, of course, in Lincoln, Nebraska, and there was the odd person who knew about her, but she was mostly running a ranch and running her family business, and people would show up and have lessons, but.
But we shouldn't forget, Robert, here in the U.S., what was going on in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Judy Leibovitz, Deborah Kaplan.
Mm-hmm.
Really getting going, mm-hmm. having been trained by Alma Frank and Luli Westfeld. So, there was a activity coming along here in New York City.
Right.
Which,
right. I vaguely knew about that.
American teachers came
of course.
Out of that. Yeah.
So getting back to Walter, what are some other things that you think Walter should be best remembered for?
Well, he, I think, made a tremendous contribution to figuring out more clearly how to train teachers, but in particular, the use of your hands as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, not everybody is going to agree with this. But Walter very specifically emphasized, in fact, this links with the sense of responsibility that first generation teachers had. In conversations we had about this, he said, by the time FM died, Walter was already in charge of the day-to-day running of the training course.
Right.
You, in Goddard Binkley's diary, actually, you can see how in the last year and a half or so of FM's life, he only came into the training course once, I think.
Right. Walter was pretty much in charge.
He said that was a responsibility he could wear very lightly while FM was alive. He said, it was FM's training course. I could always go and ask him questions. I could ask him to come in and help and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But he said when FM died, then he experienced the full weight of the responsibility. And he really worked from the premise that Alexander had said, the practice of the practice of hands on the back of the chair gives you the experiences you need to use your hands as a teacher. And that this also connected very much with using the monkey attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter said he really took that as the centerpiece and then sort of worked backwards. What do people need to experience and understand to be able to use that semi-flexed monkey attitude without going rigid?
Mm-hmm.
And that led to various ways of working with the legs and the back and so on to facilitate that. And the hands on the back of the chair, what do people need to really understand what that experience is about? And that led to really helping people to open out through the shoulders and the upper torso, so that when you're using your hands, there are your hands in front of you. They might be holding the back of a chair. They might be holding a glass of water, as I am at this exact moment. They might be holding another person's arm as you work as an Alexander teacher. But you've got to be able to take a hold of objects in the world outside without squeezing yourself at the other end of your arms. People squeeze their own upper torso with their upper arms and shoulders when they take a hold of something with their hands. And that, it took me a long time to understand this. It seems blindingly obvious, really, but it isn't. That's what hands on back of chair is about. And I think he understood that more deeply, perhaps, than anyone. And that in turn links with how it frees your breathing, because if you're squeezing yourself, you're not letting your ribs move. So out of all this comes an expression I heard him use in my early days around him that baffled all of us. He used to say, well, to work as an Alexander teacher, you've got to learn to use your hands as feet. I don't know, do you remember that phrase from the late
70s? I didn't hear that phrase, but I certainly remember, I mean, Paul and Betty Collins, who ran the course I was on, I having heard from people in the earlier days of Walter, I can see where they got a lot of their teaching methods. And I remember distinctly not just hands on back of chair, but hands on a table, lengthening out, you know, ways of lengthening your fingers out and so on. Not all of which made a lot of sense to me at the time. But I do remember, on my training course, just an amazing amount of attention paid to what do you do with yourself when you put your hands on somebody else?
Yeah, I think that's exactly where there's a need. What I thought when I started directing training courses, there was this wonderful program, but often people went through the program and they never really understood the purpose and the point. It's as if Walter was presenting this and assuming you'd just get it. And I think people need more help to understand that those practices that you remember learning from Paul and Betty, how they then translate into everyday life things, picking up a suitcase and carrying it, etc., cleaning your teeth, but also into that very subtle interplay between two people that is Alexander teaching, which leads to the terrible paradox of doing and non-doing. And you probably remember this tremendous emphasis on put your hands on, give your directions, and they might have said, you know, like the hands on the back of the chair directions, and don't try to do anything.
Exactly, yes.
And
yes.
You came out of that at the end of 3 years, rigorously drilled in this non-doing direction. And then you started working on brand new people, and you found yourself thinking, this is never going to work.
Yeah, and it does. And it does work.
Help. Yeah. Well, actually, yes and no. Because what I found fascinating, one of various things I found fascinating in being able to be around Walter for much longer than the basic 3 years, was to really begin to question him about the fact that you could sense, feel, observe. Sometimes his hands were not just there doing nothing while he directed. They were sometimes more active. How did he get to that more active way of helping you while still conveying this undoing process. Mm-hmm. That was what I found fascinating and what I felt he somehow had figured out more than anyone else. And exploring that further in questioning him and gradually getting to what I would now tend to call doing on a non-doing foundation. And I think that's, and I later, as I kind of, one of the lovely things about Walter was his utter generosity of spirit in passing on his knowledge and understanding, so that I found that if I got better at asking more precise questions, I'd get more precise answers from him. And then I'd be able to put hands on him and say, is this what you mean? Is this how you do it?
Yeah.
And so it became much clearer that, as he put it, one of the ways he put it was that, well, if you keep opening up in yourself in this non-doing way with your hands on somebody, you gradually get to feel more of what's happening in that person, and then your hands will sort of know what to do to help them, was one of his ways of expressing it. And another way of expressing it that I liked very much was that he sometimes would use his hands in what I would, you know, what you might call a more active way, but with tremendous undoing, total lack of squeezing into himself. But he said, what I'm doing is I'm really helping this person to stop doing something to themselves in the sense of really, you know, pressing and pulling down in themselves.
Right.
We found a reference in one of Raymond Dart's papers that Walter greatly enjoyed. Dart wrote that the Alexander teacher uses inhibitional manipulations.
Oh, that's a great phrase. And I should just say, for those of our listeners who don't know who Raymond Dart was, he was a South African scientist. He was pretty famous in his own right, who had lessons from a teacher in South Africa in the, I guess, the late 30s, early 40s. Teacher left, he was on his own, and he developed some procedures, which are now called the DART procedures, to help him continue with his self-development. Very interesting guy. Very famous for his
discoverer of one of the skulls,
Lucy,
right?
Lucy, skull. Very famous guy. Yeah.
I don't think he literally discovered it, as in dug it out of the ground.
But saw its importance and how it fitted in.
Yeah, he saw the significance of it. Yeah. Actually, to be accurate about the Dart quote, when I went back more recently, I think it was, in fact, inhibitional and educational manipulations. And that's even better.
That's good. That is excellent. You know, hearing you talk about this emphasis on how you use your hands when you're teaching, It's very interesting that Marge Barstow approached those same kind of issues that I think Walter was aware of, but she approached them in, I would say, a very, very different way, in more a mental way, you might say. I can hardly ever remember her talking about exactly how you're going to put your hands on somebody, and for sure you didn't put hands on her. But she, when someone on one of her workshops said, well, my activity that I'd like to do is teach someone some Alexander, that was a very interesting moment, because she would be just laser-like focused on what are you thinking about as you walk over to the table, or as you even talk to this person who's going to be your student. Not so much the details of what was going to happen with your hands, but what was going to happen in your brain, which, of course, led to very, for those people who stayed with that program, a very high quality of touch, but taught in a different way. It's fascinating. And I'm thinking of a quote that's kind of been circulating around on Facebook, a quote of Alexander's, which is, "My brain is in my hands," which, yes. You know, is either very profound or dreadful body mapping. But it is actually kind of a profound statement. And it seems to me from what you said that Walter was an example of that, maybe.
I think so. And here's another quote from FM.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to track down where this comes from, but you've probably heard it yourself, that he's supposed to have said, "I want your whole body imbued with thought."
Oh, I haven't heard that one. But that is, again, that same idea. And I think that what's interesting is you have, in this case, two second generation, or I don't know what we call them, first generation?
I think we tend to call them first.
First generation teachers, and Walter and Marge, and of course there were several others, who had the same, they both have in common that they were confronted with teaching situations that they had never anticipated. In Marge's case, it never occurred to her to teach in groups until the opportunity came up, and she just went with the flow on it. And in Walter's case, suddenly he's in charge of the training course. Alexander's not there. And I can actually remember Walter saying to me about that transitional period that there were a few students that Alexander kind of kept to himself or were just students of Alexander's. And some of them, I think, were fairly elderly. And they kind of, he inherited those students. And he said, "I had a really hard time getting them to move as easily as Alexander did, because I could see Alexander teaching them in the next room, and they would just pop out of the chair light as a feather. And when I started teaching them, wow, it didn't work that way."
I remember that. I think I heard him actually say it was shocking how difficult he found them.
That's exactly it. He was confronted with, the master's gone, and here are these people who are used to working with the master, and now it's just poor me, as it were. So he obviously, he dealt with that challenge in the best ways that he could, and I think he did a pretty amazing job of it, just as I would say Marge did a pretty amazing job working with groups, someone who it never occurred to her to do that. So
I think one of the things, something I find helpful, and I'm guessing you'll probably relate pretty easily to this, is that we can look at these different approaches, mm-hmm. Walter, Marge, Patrick McDonald, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
Who've made great contributions to this ongoing river of stream flow of the Alexander technique. And it can be helpful to see what is the downside of each of them? I'm very aware that within the Carrington tradition, you can see what happens when it doesn't go well.
Mm-hmm. And you can see that in the Marge tradition too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So I think this, it's where we can almost, you could say, where we can learn the most from sometimes is from looking at, hey, what's happening when it's not working well?
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a certain stiffness, rigidity, in somebody who's trying to apply a Carrington approach in a way that isn't going well for them.
Right.
It's as if they're thinking too much and they're thinking so much, all these little detailed directions, they're subtly holding themselves in order to think.
Right.
They're not open to receiving information, either tactile information or visual.
Yeah.
Not good. That isn't actually what we want.
Right.
So we see that and we think, okay, so if I'm going to train people in this way, I've also got to make sure that I'm not sending them down that track.
Right.
And I'm sure people in, you know, all the different traditions will, you know, see their own types of, hey, this is what happens when it doesn't work well. How can we not go down that track? Do you see what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And
I think it's a great thing to look at.
I think I totally agree with that. And I think actually I would take that one step further and look at FM himself, because, you know, probably he was not always the world's greatest Alexander teacher by modern standards. And, you know, he developed this work, and I imagine he was a pretty good teacher, but I imagine there were some flaws in his own teaching methodology that we need to just be aware that
you've probably heard it said. I mean, I know there's some video kicking around of Pat McDonald being asked about this, and Patrick. I'll have to I don't remember the exact things he said, but the gist of it was that Alexander could convey an amazing experience, had a remarkable gift with his hands that perhaps no one has got close to since.
Right.
But that he was not – oh, that's – I remember Patrick said, well, he was a very good teacher and he was a very bad teacher. That was how the conversation began.
Right, and there is
and
a
it was
whole
the lack of explanation.
Yeah,
Patrick felt was the negative.
Yeah, side. And I, you know, of course, all of these people who knew Alexander who had direct experience of them, they're almost all gone now. So we can't really interview them. But I can certainly remember it being said by some people that Alexander's brother was in some ways a better teacher, or a better teacher for some people, than Alexander was, because his brother had to struggle a bit with getting these ideas, whereas, you know, they were Alexander's. So
that would make sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there is that as well.
And of course, people also said, now I don't know about AR's temperament, but people said of FM that he did not have a patient temperament.
That's what I've heard. There's the famous blunderbuss story you probably heard, right?
Which one is that?
He had a student that was just not, I suppose, not paying attention. Who knows? A student that was frustrating him. And he got so angry that he pulled out a blunderbuss, a kind of an ancient rifle, and told him to chased him down the stairs or out onto the street. I think as a way of making a statement. And I mean, I'm sure as an Alexander teacher, you too have had students that you'd be really tempted to do something like that with. And
it's hard to
imagine Walter going down that road, you know. He just wasn't the type to do that. But yeah, I'm sure that's true, that Alexander could be very impatient with people. So all of these teachers, including the originator, had their personal foibles. But still, you know, we got the Alexander technique in a reasonably coherent form. We're talking in early 2013. So,
I think another of Alexander's foibles, if we're on that subject, is more at the level of now when we read what he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is such a weight of late 19th century evolutionary philosophy in there mm-hmm. that we don't necessarily need to carry over with us.
Oh, I agree. There's a bunch of stuff of Alexander's that we don't need to carry over. Absolutely. But I don't fault him for that. I mean, he was doing the best he could. And, you know, he was a product of his time. If you consider where he came from, what his situation was growing up in Tasmania, which was probably one of the most unpleasant places in the world at that time. It was basically a penal colony with a few people who were on parole and a lot of people who were dumped there by the Brits. It was not a pleasant place. There had just been...
I think by 1900 I don't think it was still a penal colony.
Well, not officially, but it had the highest proportion of convicts, and it was the last part of Australia to be settled, and the Aborigines were wiped out very quickly by the settlers. And in fact, the year Alexander was born, the last male Aborigine died, and it had only been 50 years. So I think he came out of a very dark place with not a lot of opportunities. And, you know, it's pretty amazing how he got out of that onto the mainland of Australia, then to London, and then to the world. His, I mean, it's an incredible story.
Yeah, the confidence and charisma he must have had. Because if we look again historically, you know, I mean, that was the era of the British Empire, which was the dominant power in the world. And he was brought up in a poor family at the outer margins of that empire. And he turned up in London. He spent money on having handmade tailored suits and handmade shirts and all that kind of thing. He developed the cultivated, educated British English accent.
Right.
And was really playing the role of a British gentleman and a member of the professional classes.
Yeah.
And he carried it off.
With not a high school education a diploma, not even a GED. I often used to think, well, what would have happened if some chance meeting back in Melbourne or Sydney had sent Alexander off to Los Angeles instead of London?
Yes.
You know, what a difference that would have made. Anyway, I think we're probably, unless there's something
historical alternative.
Yeah, another universe. We're probably pretty much at the end of, unless there's something you really want to add about Walter, we probably should bring this to an end. What do you think? Thoughts on Walter?
Yes. I think we've covered most of it. You know, that thing about the hands as feet. I just had a note to myself to make the point that when you have the basics of the freedom of the legs connected to the back, that you can bring that into the semi-flexed monkey attitude and the openness of the upper body when the hands are being used, you actually get that sense that you're almost four-footed. Mm-hmm. Hands and feet are connected via your back. And in later years, I remember he started using the expression four-footed.
That's interesting. Of course, I'm sure on his course, certainly on ours, there was a lot of creeping and crawling going on.
Yeah,
which
I
think
don't
was influenced by Dart to some
that.
Extent. But
I think that's that became a bit of a sidetrack because you know, you can practice that for 6 hours a day and still never get the underlying coordination. As you know that so often. Let's say we've talked quite a bit about Marge Barstow, and you had a lot of contact with her and Walter Carrington, and people would say, oh, well, one of the characteristics of Marge was she didn't use the procedures.
That's pretty true. Yeah.
Yes. That's
right.
And, you know, it just strikes me more and more, the problem about with procedures has always been a lack of understanding the underlying purpose of them.
I would totally agree with that. In fact, somewhere in one of Alexander's books, he addresses specifically the question of procedures versus principles. And he even says something, I wish I could find that quote now, a teacher will use whatever whatever art he has to teach.
Variations on the teacher's art.
Yeah, on the art. And that it's not like a bunch of specific procedures. It's understanding the principles and then using procedures that might be useful. But the procedures themselves, I don't think he ever attached all that much importance to. And in fact, he's also, I think this is a quote from Marjorie Barlow, maybe in one of her lectures or an article somewhere, where she says that he would tell the students on his training course back in the day, I want you to watch what I do. I want you to understand why I'm doing it. And then I want you definitely not to do the same thing because I don't want a bunch of monkeys imitating me. You know?
Yeah, that quote, it came originally from Ethel Webb.
Well, that was another story.
Oh, was that a different
story? Yeah, Ethel Webb, one of his assistants, he had his training course, was going out, had been invited somewhere to teach, and Alexander couldn't go. He sent her, and she had never actually taught before on her own. And she went up to him and said, well, what should I do? And he said, well, Ethel, just don't do anything you've ever seen me do.
That's right, yes.
Now,
yes.
You know, it's an interesting piece of advice. And
I think given that anything I've heard about FM suggests, let's say he was a little prone to hyperbole.
Absolutely, I'm sure he was.
So he probably didn't mean absolutely literally.
I'm sure that's true. But he was saying something important about principles.
Yes.
Versus procedures.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think, this is where, you know, perhaps we differ slightly going back to when we talked about foundation, that I feel from the kind of background or tradition within the Alexander community that I've come from, I want to bring forward procedures, including chair work and so on, but I want to bring them forward constantly emphasizing what's the point of this? Why are we doing this? What is the underlying principle that you're going to bring into every activity?
Well, I think this would be a great place to end our conversation. This is going to be a great resource, I think, for people, teachers and students. My guest today has been John Nichols, who is an Alexander Technique teacher now living in New York City. He's the co-director of the AT New York City Teacher Training Program. He studied with Walter and Dillis for many years and worked on their training course. And if you live in the New York City area, we'll put a link to the website of that certification program. We're also, you still teach private lessons, right?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
And
keep in touch with that.
So if you live in the New York area, I would definitely get hold of John. We'll also put a link to a site where if you live anywhere else in the world, you can find a teacher in your area. John, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's been a great pleasure and a lot of fun. Thanks for inviting me, Robert.